recently abated, was returning with a terrible vengeance. If this came out at the second trial, they would look like fools. Depending on how good Myers's new attorney was, and how much he exploited this blunder, they might even lose the conviction. Chapter 35. My first shift began Thursday morning and stretched into Thursday afternoon, encompassing both the breakfast and lunch rushes. The manager believed in leadership by beratement, so most of my time was spent being chastised for one minor transgression or another, like how I didn't properly orient the bills in the cash register. For 8 hours of hard labor and censure, my tips totaled $51.74, the most generous of which came when a trucker told me to keep the change after handing me a 10 for a $5.79 tab. To be fair, I earned it. He had stayed there 2 hours, insisted on 9 coffee refills, and ogled my ass every time I walked away. As I trudged back out toward my car, wearing my blue button-down Waffle House shirt and cheap black pants, the urge to quit was overwhelming. My feet and ankles throbbed. My hair felt and smelled like it had been infused with bacon grease. The rest of me reeked like burnt coffee. The only thing that stopped me from turning back around and telling the manager where she could shove her cash register was Alex. I thought of Judge Stone, staring at me haughtily from on high, asking me if I had gotten a job like he asked. I needed to be able to answer in the affirmative. I flopped in my car and, feeling too tired to even turn the ignition right away, checked my phone. It had 2 messages waiting. The first was a voicemail from Mr. Honeywell. He had filed a motion to suppress the search warrant in my criminal case. He said the clerk would schedule us for a motion hearing and that it would likely be soon. The matter needed to be adjudicated before the April 9th trial date. Then he hung up. He did not acknowledge or attempt to explain the strange end to our conversation on the bench. Maybe he never would. The second message was a text from Teddy. "Hey, I have some good news that might lead to better news. Where are you?" I don't want to say I had forgotten about Teddy since Monday, when I had learned he was once again gallivanting with Wendy. But his newest dalliance with danger simply hadn't been a priority. As had been the case in the past with Teddy, I had enough problems without adding in his issues. "Where am I?" I thought. "Where are you, Teddy? And what the hell have you been up to?" But I didn't text that. I was too tired for the drama. So I just tapped out, "Heading home. Where are you?" Then I got back on my way toward Desper Hollow. Halfway there, Teddy texted back, "I'll be right there. I have a surprise. A good one." Great, I thought. I can't wait. When I got home, it seemed to take the breast pump longer than ever to draw milk out of me. It was one more thing that was making me feel grim as I changed out of my Waffle House finery. I had just finished when I heard a truck rumbling up the driveway. I opened a slit in the blinds to have a look. Sure enough, it was Teddy. But that wasn't the reason I was cursing and fuming as I ran back down the steps toward the front door. It was who he had in the passenger seat. Wendy Matea. The succubus herself. The first time I met Wendy, she was maybe 16. And she was already beautiful to the point of distraction, this human concoction that I thought only existed in romance novels. Hair so dark brown it was practically black, flawless pale skin, huge green eyes that brought to mind emeralds, and, what the guys liked best, an hourglass figure so curvy and yet so impossibly slim in the waist that you'd swear she was wearing a corset. But let's be clear, I didn't hate her because she was gorgeous or had a great body. I hated her because, in all the time I had known her, she had done nothing but lie to me, steal from me, and lead my baby brother to the gates of hell and back. I was on my front porch as they got out of the truck. "What is she doing here?" I demanded. "She's been helping me," Teddy said, innocently and a bit goofily, the way he always talked when he was around Wendy. He looked like he hadn't shaved in 2 days. Wendy liked Scruff.
"Are you sober?"
"Yes," he insisted.
"You can stop with the Spanish Inquisition. We're both sober."
He had joined her at the hood of the truck, and they were now coming up the walk, hand in hand. Wendy wore tight jeans, a t-shirt that barely contained her oversized bosom, and a hoodie that was unzipped so as not to obscure her best feature.
"She can't come in," I said,
because while I could always tell whether Teddy was stoned, I was never sure with Wendy. Her looks had this way of hiding everything.
"Would you take it easy? She's finally trying to get right."
"Yeah?
How long have you been clean, Wendy?"
3 weeks, she said.
"Oh, Jesus," I said, rolling my eyes. How many times had I heard earnest professions of new leaves being turned over that lasted a week or two or four before they reverted back? A junkie claiming sobriety after 3 weeks was really just someone whose resolve had yet to be adequately tested. Wendy was now directly beneath me, still clutching Teddy's hand, looking up at me with those witchy emerald eyes.
"Melanie, I know I've wronged you. I've wronged a lot of people, actually. But when I think of you, I know I've done a lot of bad stuff to you. I mean, there was the bracelet, and the thing with your credit card, and that time with your car, and I guess there have been a bunch of times, and I'm sorry, okay? I really am sorry. And I'm going to try to do everything I can to make it up to you."
"Nice speech," I spat. "Where'd you get it? The Narcotics Anonymous website?"
"Come on, sis. She's trying. Would you give her a chance?"
"I did. 7 years ago. Then again, 6 years ago. Do you really need me to rehash everything? I can if you want." Teddy took a step boldly forward.
"Okay, okay, I get it. You're still pissed. But we don't have time for that right now."
And then, with his free hand, he reached into his back pocket, unfolded a piece of photo paper he had extracted, then held it out so I could see it. I recognized the side view of my A1 plumber mystery man, blown up to an 8x10.
"She knows who this guy is," Teddy said. "And he might be meeting with us in a little bit. You want to hear more or not?"
They followed me inside and sat stiffly on the couch, like they were meeting someone's mother for the first time. I remained standing in front of them with my arms crossed, still too distrustful of Wendy to let my guard down.
"Let's hear it," I said. "As soon as I saw the picture, I recognized the guy," Teddy said. "I didn't know his name or anything, but he's one of those guys who kind of hangs around downtown or out at the mission."
Valley Mission was a homeless shelter in a storefront on West Beverly Street, on the other side of Thorn Rose Cemetery. I had tried it once or twice after I got kicked out of my apartment, but decided I preferred my car. The mission itself was clean and well-run. It was the clientele that proved a bit much for me. The area around the mission served as ground zero for Stanton drug culture. There had been at least a dozen times, during Teddy's wild years, when his mother called me in a panic and told me he had disappeared again. Probably half the time, I found him hanging out on the well-worn path between the bars downtown and the mission, stoned out of his mind. Teddy continued,
"So I know you said I was just supposed to look at the picture and not do anything with it,
but I kind of assumed you didn't really mean it, especially since you were in jail and couldn't do anything about it. And, well, anyway, on Saturday, I kind of went out to the mission, just to scope things out.
Oh, Teddy, I said, burying my face in my hands. The scenario he was describing, putting himself among the people and places that had so often led to his drug use, was a recipe for relapse.
Relax, relax. I was just looking, not talking to anyone or anything. Anyway, that's when I saw Wendy.
Naturally. The people at the mission are trying to hook me up with a real job, she said. In the meantime, I've been volunteering, serving lunches and that sort of thing.
Of course she had been, because now that she was 3 weeks sober, she was practically a candidate for sainthood. I didn't actually talk to her at first, Teddy said, because, you know, she's a trigger and all that.
Wait, I thought you were a trigger for me, she teased, patting him on the knee. They were being so nauseatingly sweet with each other, I didn't have to ask if they were sleeping together again. My plight had become their romantic quest. And yes, it had started with noble intentions. I feared its end all the same. In truth, it wasn't alcohol, marijuana, or heroin that was the common theme in my brother's battle with addiction. Wendy Matea had always been his drug of choice. Anyway, I kind of hung back, not wanting to talk to her or anyone, really, Teddy said. I was just there to look for the guy from the picture. And then she finally came up to me. Wendy picked up the story.
And I was like, I see you, you big dummy. It's kind of hard to miss a guy who's 6'4" and gorgeous, you know?
Anyway, we started talking, and she was telling me about how things were different this time.
They had to be different after what happened to me. I woke up in the back of an ambulance and, like, 3 days of my life were gone. The EMTs said when they found me, my heart was stopped. They had to give me Narcan and everything.
She shuddered.
Anyhow, I'm done this time, Wendy continued. Seriously. No more drugs. No more booze. Not even weed. I get that if I don't quit, I'm going to wind up being a statistic.
Teddy resumed the narrative.
So after we got talking, I showed her the picture.
And I was immediately like, oh my God, that's Slash, Wendy exclaimed.
Slash? I said.
Yeah, Wendy said. I mean, that's what people call him because of the scar and all. He's this, I don't know, drifter, I guess you'd say. He claims he paints houses for a living, but I've never seen him with a truck or paintbrushes or anything like that. He's just another one of those guys you see around. When he's not at the mission, he's at the Hardee's or the bus stop near the Howard Johnson. So I asked Teddy if he had checked there.
And I hadn't, Teddy said. But that's where we went next. We started asking around a little bit. We kind of kept it on the down low. I mean, I think people just thought we were looking for him to buy drugs, but whatever. Anyhow, this is where it gets kind of interesting, because apparently everyone down at the bus stop said Slash had some kind of big score recently. He doesn't take the bus anymore.
As of when? I asked.
Well, that's exactly the point. The word is he dropped out of sight about 2 weeks ago. He went from being normal old Slash, taking a bus out to this job he had, staying at the mission or at a boarding house when he had the money for it, and then all of a sudden, he was flush.
Because someone paid him a bunch of money to plant drugs in my house, I said.
That's what we think, Wendy said.
But you said you had a meeting with him? I asked.
How'd you set up that? We kind of put the word out that we wanted to talk to him, Teddy said. We found a few people who knew him, and we said we were looking for him, that it was a business thing, and that we would be hanging out at Hardee's around dinner time if he wanted to find us.
And that worked? I asked.
Not the first few days, Teddy said.
Monday and Tuesday we went there and nothing.
I thought back to Monday. I had shown up at Teddy's place at maybe 5:15 or 5:20. That's why I had just missed them. They were heading out to what they hoped was a rendezvous with Slash.
But then yesterday, Wendy said, one of his buddies came by and was like, you looking for Slash? And we were like, yeah. And he was all, what do you want with him? And we played it pretty cool and were like, I guess you'll have to come by and see. So this guy texted Slash and Slash texted back and said he'd meet us around 5 today.
I looked at the clock on the wall. It was 4:45. Chapter 36. We piled into Teddy's truck, the three of us sharing the front bench. On the way, we decided that since Slash was expecting only 2 people, not 3, I needed to keep my distance. Also, compared to Teddy and Wendy, with their tattoos and piercings, I looked like a den mother, with my untorn jeans and uninked skin. Just the sight of me might cause him to spook and run. So it would be up to Teddy and Wendy to coax Slash's real name out of him. They said they had some ideas how they might go about that. Once armed with a name, Mr. Honeywell could subpoena the man. Maybe he wouldn't show up in court, and maybe if he did, he'd lie under oath, sure. But merely being able to show a jury that the guy with the scar was a real person, likely one with a long criminal history, would be something. If Slash was too cagey to give us his name, which seemed likely, I could at least get some better pictures of him. I was going under the assumption Slash was known to local law enforcement. Maybe a friendly cop would help us out with a name. That was about as far as our planning got. As we neared the end of the short ride, I turned to Wendy and said, "Thank you, by the way. I really do appreciate your help."
"You're welcome," she said.
We left it at that. When we were 2 blocks from the restaurant, I had Teddy drop me off so we wouldn't be seen getting out of the same vehicle. By the time I got to Hardy's, Wendy and Teddy were already seated at a booth across the way from the counter. The establishment was otherwise empty, except for one elderly couple chewing their dinners in silence. I ordered a thick burger, even though I was far too nervous to be hungry, then sat 2 booths away from my brother and sank my eyes into my phone. My burger was brought out to me a few minutes later. I nibbled at it. 5 o'clock came and went. No one else entered the restaurant. 10 minutes went by. Then 15. Teddy's legs were bouncing up and down. Another elderly couple came in. Then 2 kids with their father, who wandered by and leered at Wendy even as he pretended to be concerned with his children's meal orders. He sat a few tables away, turned so he had a nice view of her. Nothing else of even minor consequence happened. I rechecked the same email I had already read 3 times, then perused headlines whose words I couldn't even parse. The time slipped from 5:25 to 5:35. I couldn't imagine men who went by the nickname Slash were especially worried about punctuality, but I was starting to think we had been stood up. Then, at 5:37, I felt a slight change in air pressure as the door behind me opened. I didn't turn, because a woman lost in her phone wouldn't notice someone walking in. But Teddy's eyes had locked in on whoever had walked in. Then a man walked by me, without moving my head or seeming to remove my attention from my screen. I shoved my eyes hard left. Slash was even more angular in real life than he was on camera. His face and arms were almost entirely devoid of fat. He was white, racially anyway, but his skin had the rawhide coloring of a man who spent most of his time outside. The only thing truly white on him was that scar, which looped over the top of his head from one ear to the other, like a set of very thin headphones worn too far forward. He stopped in front of Teddy and Wendy's table.
"Y'all looking for me?"
he said, his southern accent thick. "Sup," my brother said casually.
"Wendy, right?"
he said to her.
"Yeah."
"We were at that thing at Cooch's one time."
I had no idea who or what Cooch's was, but I'm guessing Slash remembered Wendy a lot more than the other way around.
"Oh, yeah," she said. "That was epic."
"Have a seat,"
Teddy said, cleverly switching over to Wendy's side of the table. It meant Slash would have to sit facing me. Slash slid into the booth. With my camera app already loaded, I brought my phone up, while still acting like I was reading headlines, and tried to get a clean picture of him. It was impossible. Slash was too strung out. His movements were rapid, almost bird-like. In the span of a few seconds, he wiped his running nose with the back of his hand, cracked his neck, and brought his elbows up to the table. That last act hunched him far enough forward that his face was mostly blocked from my view by Teddy's back. I lowered my phone so I wouldn't seem suspicious.
"So, I might have something I need done," my brother said, sounding older than his 23 years, semi-muffling his voice in his hands. "Yeah, what's that?"
Slash asked, looking everywhere but at my brother.
"I hear you're good at getting people in trouble."
Slash's head quick-jerked left then right.
"Don't know what you're talking about. I paint houses."
"That woman on the news? I hear that was you, planting that stuff in her house." Slash's denial of this was laced with curse words.
"Yeah, yeah, I know,"
Teddy said, playing it cool. "But let's just say I wanted you to do the same thing to someone else." Slash was now even more animated and agitated. He wiped his nose again. I still wasn't trying to take his picture. It was too big a risk for too little chance at success.
"You working for the cops or something?" he demanded. "You a snitch?"
"Are you serious?" Teddy said.
"Come on, Slash, you think I'd really be hanging out with someone like that?" Wendy said.
"I think he could be, and you wouldn't even know it," Slash fumed. "They got snitches all over, you know."
Said the guy who would know.
"I'm not working for the cops," Teddy insisted. "I just got someone I need to F up, that's all." "Then why don't you do it yourself?" Slash asked.
"Because I hear you do it right. Where'd you get that plumber's van, anyway?"
Slash got a little smile on his face and, for the first time, stopped moving quite so much. I quickly brought my phone back up like I was taking a selfie and tapped off 5 quick pictures. Then I brought my phone back down to look at the results. All of them missed. I got Teddy's wide shoulders, the back of Wendy's head. None had Slash's face.
"How you know about that?"
Slash asked.
"Doesn't matter. I just know people."
"Lift up your shirt,"
Slash said.
"Huh?"
Teddy said, confused.
"I want to see if you're wearing a wire."
"Whatever, man," Teddy said, and, without standing, brought the hem of his t-shirt up to his chin for a moment.
"Let's see your phone. You could be recording this."
Teddy fished it out of his pocket, tapped in his PIN, then handed it to Slash for inspection. While Slash was distracted, I brought my phone up, more brazenly this time, and took a few more pictures of him. But I worried all I was getting was the top of his head. It shouldn't have been so difficult, getting a picture of someone who didn't know they were being photographed. But I was starting to panic. I wouldn't be able to pull it off.
"Slash, he's not working for the cops," Wendy said.
Slash ignored her. He sniffed loudly.
"Yeah, well, I still don't know what you're talking about, but you couldn't afford it anyway."
"How do you know?" Teddy asked.
"Because if I did that sort of thing, and I don't, I'd need at least 5. 5? Teddy said. As in 5,000? You said it, not me. It's that, and you supply the stuff. But I take 10% of it as a thank you.
Okay, I hear you. I hear you. Damn, Teddy said, looking at Wendy.
You think our friend will be able to make that happen?
Maybe, Wendy said, playing along. He can get the product, but he's going to want to do the Western Union thing. Send the money straight to Slash. No way he's going to trust us with that much cash.
The Western Union thing? Where was Wendy going with that? I wasn't going to be able to wire anyone money I didn't have. Meanwhile, my angle for a picture had gotten worse. Teddy was blocking me again.
Yeah, you're probably right, Teddy said.
Western Union?
Slash said.
I don't know about that, man.
No, it's really easy, Teddy said. Our guy pays us this way all the time. He wires the money to Western Union. You can cash it out at the grocery store. You give them your name and your ID, they give you the money. What is your real name anyway? I could have that money waiting for you there tomorrow.
Ah, now I got it. Genius.
Except Slash was now bouncing around again.
Nah, man. It's cash or nothing.
Our guy won't do cash, Teddy said.
This is some bull right here, Slash said. You're just trying to mess me up. I paint houses. That's it.
He slid out of the booth and stood. Now desperate, I brought my phone up, squared him in the camera's frame, and started furiously jabbing at my screen. I was going to get as many shots as I could and hope one of them was decent.
Come on, man, Teddy said. Don't be like that.
Slash wasn't hearing it. He swore at my brother one more time, then started heading for the door. That put him on a path directly for my booth. This was my chance, my only one. He took one step toward me, then another. I had dropped any pretense at subtlety. I was firing as fast as I could, my finger a blur. As he passed directly by me, he looked down for a moment, and I could almost see the curiosity crossing through his drugged brain. What's she doing? Why is she aiming that thing at me? But ultimately, he couldn't reach any solid conclusions about the random woman on her phone. His neurons were too jammed up with other stuff, with anger and suspicion at my brother, with the cocaine he had just taken, and the cocaine he had done in the past. All he did was walk on by. As soon as he was out the door, Teddy and Wendy came over.
Nice try with the Western Union thing, I said.
It was worth a shot, Teddy said. Did you get any good pictures?
I switched over to the photo gallery and started scrolling through them. And yes. Yes, I did. The ones as he got up and left the restaurant captured him perfectly, in focus, in the middle of the screen, and square on. I handed the phone to Teddy. He smiled.
Good stuff, he said, then showed it to Wendy.
Bingo, she said.
I'm going to email these to my lawyer right now, I said. I selected the best photo, then included a short narrative about our Hardee's rendezvous. If a cop wouldn't help Mr. Honeywell with an ID, someone would. Maybe another defense lawyer who had represented Slash in the past. Maybe a bail bondsman. Someone had to know Slash's real name. Once I sent the best photo on its way, we squeezed ourselves back into Teddy's truck. On our way home, we discussed what we had just heard. Slash's employer had procured a half kilo of cocaine, plus 50 grams as an added bonus to an addict, created a fake decal for a van, then paid Slash $5,000 to break into my house and plant the drugs there. That employer, the person who wanted to separate Alex from me, had obviously gone through a lot of trouble and planning. And it was now clear, if it hadn't been reasonable to conclude already, that it was a person with some financial resources.
The first question was, who? It was, obviously, someone who wanted a baby. But there had to be easier ways to go about getting one. Which led me to the question that really bewildered me. Why Alex? Had someone just randomly selected a healthy white baby boy and gone after him? Or was it because his mother was both well-educated, and thus likely to pass her smarts onto her offspring, and poor, and thus unlikely to be able to put up much of a fight when she was framed? Or was there something in particular about Alex this person prized? I didn't have any answers, and neither did Teddy or Wendy. It was getting dark by the time we pulled back into my driveway, but I was surprised to see the lights of his truck glinting off a vehicle that was now parked there, a sedan I didn't recognize.
"Who's that?" Teddy asked.
"Beats me," I said. We came to a stop. I hopped out of the truck. As I did, two people emerged from the car, a man from the driver's side, a woman from the passenger's side. They walked toward us. As soon as their faces became clear, I felt myself rock backward. I had to lean against the truck for support. They looked like the doppelgangers of two people I knew long ago in another life. They were now older, their features thinned out and wrinkled, their movements creakier. But of course I recognized them. There are some faces you never forget, for however much you might like to. They just stood there for a moment, grinning awkwardly. I didn't know whether to run away screaming, demand that they leave immediately, or have Teddy ram them with his truck. And then my mother said, "Hello, Pumpkin. We've missed you so much." Chapter 37. It's difficult for a man to get his thoughts straight when he's just done two lines of cocaine and he's already itching for a third.
"What the hell was that all about?"
Slash wondered as he walked, head down, away from the Hardys. Then he asked himself,
"What if they really could come up with $5,000? Should I go back?"
It was tempting, to be honest. The job he had done on that woman, the one who was now all over the paper, was pretty easy. There was the one night when he stole her phone, and the man hiring him had told him exactly where he could find it. And then there was that next afternoon, breaking back into the place to plant the drugs. A few hours here and there for $5,000, and all that coke. What if it was that easy again? What if these people, Smoking Hot Wendy and whoever that guy was, could really deliver? But no. Slash didn't like the vibe. Why did they need his name? Why didn't they just deal in cash like everyone else? He could practically smell the trap, and he wanted no part of it. He had been in jail before, and he was not eager to go back. With all the time he had hanging over his head, suspended sentences and whatnot, all it would take was one slip-up. He wanted more money, yeah. He knew he was going quickly through what had once been a nice stack of $100 bills. But this payday wasn't worth the risk. Worrying that Wendy and that guy might be watching him or trying to follow him, Slash got the brilliant-seeming idea to walk past the Howard Johnson, where he was staying, until he was out of sight. Then he doubled back around, entering from around the other side, and took the stairs up to room 307. He had been there for more than a week, watching HBO, doing lines, having a one-man party with the privacy please sign hanging on the door, going out to celebrate, then coming back to the room and celebrating some more. This was the biggest score of Slash's life, and he had been enjoying the hell out of it. Because, man, when you compared it to the mission, or to sleeping in the woods, life was pretty damn good at Howard Johnson. Nice roof over your head, soft bed to sleep on. No one to say you couldn't be high or you had to wake up and get your ass out at a certain time. No one to throw Jesus in your face. After he re-entered the room, he put the chain on the door, suddenly curious as to how his supplies were holding out. He removed his stash from its hiding spot. At first, he had tried to be judicious in how much he used, rationing himself. No more than, say, 8 lines a day. Well, okay, maybe 12. Or 16, but that was it. Lately, he hadn't been paying as much attention. And there was a woman or two he had partied with, and... Wait, was that all he had left? Where was the rest of it? The money situation was even more startling. Out of the original $5,000, he was down to $1,400 bills. Yeah, Howard Johnson was expensive, and the manager had insisted on a $500 deposit against damage because Slash didn't have a credit card. And yeah, he had gone out a lot, and yeah, there had been those women. But had he really gone through that much cash already? He needed another line. Now. That would help him think straight. He got out his razor blade, mirror, and the rolled-up 100 he had been using, because it made him feel like a tough-ass gangsta. Except the coke didn't settle him. It only made him more anxious. Where had all the money gone? Had someone stolen from him? And who was that guy with Wendy? How had they known about him in the first place? He looked at the coke. He did another line. The thoughts in his head were a real jumble now, but eventually one kept coming back to him. He should call the man, the one who hired him. That would fix everything. Slash fumbled with his phone until he finally got it to make the call.
What do you want? The man answered.
Hey, it's Slash.
Yeah, I know, the man said. What do you want?
I just had some dude asking me if I could plant coke in someone else's house. He acted like he knew about that woman I did it on.
What? Who?
I don't know, Slash said. Just this dude. I don't know him. He had this chick with him. I think her name is Wendy.
Wendy? Describe Wendy for me.
She's... Damn, I mean, she's a piece of ass like you wouldn't believe. Super hot.
What color is her hair?
Brown, black, whatever.
What color are her eyes?
I don't know. I was too busy looking at her jugs.
What else? Does she have any tattoos?
Yeah, a couple of them.
Okay, the man whispered. Then it's nothing to worry about.
Hell, it's not. How'd they know about me?
I don't know. Did you tell anyone? Brag to one of your drug friends?
Nah, man. I didn't say nothing to no one.
Well, I sure didn't tell anyone.
Then how do they know about me? Slash asked.
I don't know. And then Slash came out with it.
I want more money. And more coke.
What? No. Forget it.
There's more risk now. These people know about me. That's risk I hadn't planned on.
That's your problem, not mine.
If this gets out, it'll be worse for you than for me. I'm not the one who pretends to live this straight life.
That was true. They both knew it. No way, the man said. I don't have it anyway.
Which? The money or the coke?
Either. Don't call me again. The man hung up. Slash did another line.
Chapter 38. My first instinct, as it always had been around my parents, was to protect Teddy. I had no idea why they were suddenly showing up in my driveway, or how they found me,
or what they hoped to achieve there. Whatever it was, I didn't want Teddy to be anywhere near it. His recovery was teetering on a precarious ledge, which crumbled just a little more every time he looked at Wendy. I feared if he understood who these two strangers were, it would be the small shove needed to send him toppling into the abyss.
"Stay right there," I snarled at my parents. "Don't move."
Still using the truck for balance, I forced myself back to the door and yanked it open. "You have to leave, now," I said, a little too breathlessly.
"Who are those people?"
Teddy asked. "No one," I said.
"Oh, okay," Teddy stammered. "Are you sure you have to leave now, goddammit?"
I said through gritted teeth. My parents were walking toward the truck. I slammed Teddy's door.
"Stop right there!" I yelled at my parents.
I couldn't allow them to see Teddy through the windshield. There was probably little chance they would recognize the baby they had last seen at 9 months now that he was a 23-year-old man, but I didn't want to risk it. They stopped. I could feel Teddy's indecision from inside the truck, so I banged twice on the hood and again yelled, "Get out of here!" As he finally began backing down the driveway, I squared to face my parents for the first time since they abandoned me 22 years earlier. My mother's hair, which had been dark brown like mine the last time I had seen it, was now almost completely gray. Her face was weathered, but she was far more clear-eyed than in most of my memories of her, and, all things considered, she definitely looked better than I assumed she would. Then again, I thought she was dead. My father was still broad-shouldered, though more hunched, and not nearly as tall. His hair, which had been bushy and sand-colored, was now gray and mostly gone. He had grown a mustache, which was closer to the color his hair used to be. They stood there at the bumper of their car with nervously hopeful expressions. I couldn't count the number of times during my teenage years I had imagined this moment. My parents showing up unexpectedly, announcing they were ready to resume their roles in my life. Most of the time, the scene involved me reciting a long list of the horrors and indignities I had been subjected to because of them, because before there was any talk of absolution, there had to be punishment. In those waking daydreams, I tried out a great variety of emotions, typically beginning with fury over what they had done, before moving on to gratitude at being rescued. But now that they were actually here, I was mostly just stuck on fury.
"How did you find me?" I demanded.
My mother started with,
"Pumpkin, I'm sorry, I just..." "Stop calling me Pumpkin. I'm a grown woman. My name is Melanie."
"Yes, Melanie, of course."
"We wanted to call first," my father said, "but all we could find for you was an address, not a phone number. I'm sorry we..."
"Answer my question. How did you find me?"
My mother started shaking and crying. I would have felt sympathy for any other woman in that situation. Not her. She had been the cause of too many of my own tears.
"Your mother read about you on the internet,"
my father volunteered.
"She's been looking for you for years."
"I prayed and prayed I'd find you," she said. "The social workers would never tell us where you and Teddy had gone. We knew the family that adopted Teddy had left the area, but we had no idea where they moved. The people at social services said if you wanted to reach out to us, that would be one thing, but they couldn't give us any information about you."
"Privacy laws,"
my father volunteered. My mother continued, "Your father was out longlining when I saw an article about
your problem. We came here as soon as he got back. I didn't realize you had changed your name. Are you married now?
What do you care? I snapped.
Melanie, honey, I'm so, so sorry. I've done so many terrible things in my life. So many things I can't tell you how much I regret them, she said, her voice trembling. After we lost you,
you didn't lose me. You abandoned me.
I know, she said. I can't expect you to understand what a dark, dark place I was in. I hated everything about myself. There was this hole in the middle of me, and I know you might not believe this, but I really thought that terminating our rights was the best thing we could do for you.
Great. Congratulations on that, I said.
Melanie, please. We don't deserve your forgiveness, and we're not even asking for it, but we got cleaned up. It took some years and a whole lot of pain, but we both came to realize how sick and destructive we were, and how substance abuse was at the root of all of it. We gave our lives over to Jesus Christ, and with his love, we don't use drugs or alcohol anymore. We go to a wonderful church.
Fabulous, I said. Why don't you go back there now?
My mother brought her hand to her mouth in a failed effort to stanch a sob. I was being cruel and juvenile, like I was reverting back to the 9-year-old I was when they left me. And I didn't care. They deserved so much worse.
Melanie, my father began, we know you're angry, but
stop talking, I growled at him. You don't even have a right to talk. Forget about what you did to me and this poor woman. How are you not in jail after what you did to Charlotte?
His head immediately went down.
Oh, what? You think I didn't know about that? I said, yelling now. Or did you think I would forget? What kind of man has sex with any 14-year-old girl? Much less his wife's daughter? You're a disgusting, disgusting human being.
It was strangely exhilarating to have this confrontation, to say the things in real life I had said in my head so many times.
We didn't have sex. When I was drunk, I would just...
Shut up! I shrieked. Just shut up! There's no excuse for what you did. None.
Your father spent 5 years in jail because of that, my mother said quietly. That's when he stopped drinking and was born again. He's been sober since he came out. It wasn't him doing those things to Charlotte. It was the alcohol. He never would have...
Is that what you tell yourself so you can sleep at night? I railed at her. Well, I'm glad that works for you. It doesn't quite cut it for me.
I know, my father said. I don't blame you one bit. I'm ashamed of what I've done, and one day I'm going to be judged for it. I know. All I can do for the rest of my time here is to try to live in the word of Jesus and ask for his forgiveness.
Why don't you start by asking Charlotte? I sneered.
This brought a lurching halt to their attempts at explanation and apology. My mother and father bounced glances off each other. They shifted their weight. My father exhaled noisily.
Didn't anyone tell you? My mother asked.
Tell me what?
Charlotte, she... Oh, honey, this was so long ago. Charlotte died of a drug overdose when she was 19. She had run off to New York City and had gotten into some bad things. And
Oh, Melanie. The news of my half-sister's death, delivered however many years too late, was one more piece of information I couldn't put in proper perspective. Not standing in my driveway. Not while facing the parents I hadn't seen since I was 9 years old. I always assumed Charlotte had been like me, off with a new life somewhere, surviving, even if she wasn't fully healed from the scars inflicted by Mr. and Mrs. William Theodore Curran. Instead, it turned out she was their most profoundly affected victim. All this time I should have been mourning her. If only I had known. Yet when she succumbed to her sadness, she had already aged out of the system, and I was halfway across the state. There was no one who would have even thought to tell me. There was no one who cared.
Well, that's just great. Thanks for letting me know 17 years too late, I said, using my sarcasm as a shield. If you don't mind, I'm going to go into my house now and enjoy that news. Good night.
I stomped off quickly toward my front porch and those overturned bulbs, which were still exactly where I had left them, but now browner and frostbitten.
Melanie, we're here because we want to help, my mother said plaintively, taking a few steps toward me. We've hired a lawyer. We're asking the court to consider placing your son with us permanently. We're his grandparents, you know. We can take care of him while you sort through your issues.
I whirled to face them again. This was beyond any nightmare the darkest reaches of my subconscious could have whipped up for me.
Oh, my God! I screeched. You think that's helping? You think you did such a bang-up job raising me and Teddy and Charlotte that you really deserve a shot at screwing up the next generation, too? Are you really serious? You people are unbelievable.
My father put his arm around my mother.
I know this is a shock, seeing us, he said, and I know you're upset, and you have every right to be. But our lawyer says,
I don't want to hear!
This is the best way for you to be able to keep your child. We can adopt your son, and he can live with us while you serve your jail time. Then, when you get out, we can all be together as a family.
I brought my hands to the sides of my head, clutching two fistfuls of hair.
A family? Is that a joke? You're really talking to me about family? We were a family. And you, sir, threw it into a big drunken meat grinder until there was nothing left of it.
I know, my father said. And I can see you're too upset to talk right now. We're staying at the Econo Lodge not far from here. Can I at least leave our phone numbers with you so you can call us if you want to talk?
You know what I want? I said. I want you to get out of my driveway and get out of my life. You were doing the best parenting you could do by staying away from me. You should have kept it that way.
I opened my front door, then slammed it behind me with all the strength I could muster. At first, I was too angry to even have distinct thoughts. I ran upstairs to the nursery, if only to put that much more distance between myself and them. From the relative safety of the second floor, I watched them. They leaned against each other in a sort of hug, and seemed to be talking things over. Then they walked slowly back to their car. For a minute or so, they just sat there with the engine running and the lights on. It was hard to tell what they were doing from my angle. I worried they were just regrouping,
trying to decide on a new line of attack. Finally, they backed down the driveway. At the end of it, they stopped. My father got out, opened my mailbox, and put something inside of it. A note? A piece of paper with their phone numbers on it? Then they drove away. The first identifiable emotion I felt after they were finally gone was that I was furious with myself for being furious. I wanted to be the grown woman who had moved on, not the petulant teenager flailing at them, landing cheap shots wherever I could. They shouldn't have been able to reach me like that anymore. But I couldn't stop the anger. With my entire life in turmoil, with forces unknown conspiring to separate me from my child and send me to prison, Mommy and Daddy Dearest chose this time, of all times, to re-enter my life. And they did it not with a letter or with some non-invasive approach that put the interaction on my terms and allowed me to decide whether I wanted it. They did it on their terms, which was nothing unusual, really. It had always been all about Billy and Betsy. Even now, when they were coming with this offer of so-called help, I felt like they were really just trying to use me as another piece of the testimony they would offer their congregation. Jesus is so good. He even gave us back our daughter after all these years. Hallelujah! Praise him! Not knowing what else to do with myself, I took Mr. Snuggs into the crook of my arm and sat in the nursing chair. I thought about what my father had said, about them adopting Alex, or fostering him, or whatever absurdity they were proposing. Unbelievably, I was actually considering it. Was it, in fact, the best of my non-existent options? My father was right. If the courts would give Alex to his grandparents, he would remain in my life even if I did end up incarcerated. There was a state women's prison in Goochland, less than 2 hours from Northumberland. If I were sent there, they could visit every weekend. I wouldn't miss him growing up. More important, he would know that he still had a mother, that his mother loved him more than anything, and that all she wanted was to be with him. Then, when I got out, we could be together again. Alex would be, what, 6? It would be strange for him at first, sure. But there was still a whole lot of parenting left to be done from age 6 until whenever he left the nest. 6-year-olds were just losing their first teeth. They hadn't read Roald Dahl or learned to play complex board games or been introduced to multiplication or done any of the things I imagined myself doing with Alex. And yes, my parents were pretty far from ideal. It would be taking a great leap of faith on my part that they really had changed, and that they could keep him safe and loved until I got out. The alternative was that Alex would be ripped away from me forever, to be raised by the top bidder in the white baby auction. But would that actually be worse or better? It was possible they were some nice couple, totally unaware they were on the receiving end of a criminal enterprise. They had been told the tens of thousands they had paid was for medical care or some legitimate expense. I could spin 1,000 scenarios in which they were actually loving parents. I could spin just as many that ended a lot less nicely. As I wrestled with the issue, a memory came to me. I was maybe 7, and my father had just come back from Nova Scotia or someplace like that. I was still at an age where I mindlessly aped my mother's reactions to most things, so I was excited he had returned. because she was excited. After all, it was going to be different this time. She had done up her hair and was wearing a new dress. We had a nice